Hello, I'm Susan, and you're listening to Kickapoo Nightlife on WDRT 91.9 FM in Viroqua, Wisconsin. And this program, we have a special interview with Dr. Richard Green from the University of Arizona. And he has a lot to say about dark sky and conservation and what's going on in astronomy. So instead of all the other things we usually put in a program, we're going to just cut right to his interview and listen to what he has to say about some interesting topics. We'll see you at the end of the program. Okay, today I'm talking with astronomer Dr. Richard Green in Tucson, Arizona. He's had a long career as an astronomer and now is Stewart Observatory Assistant Director for Government Relations. And Dr. Green works primarily on astronomical site protection. He has a long history in astronomy, doing many things, some things you might recognize, such as working on projects with the Hubble Space Telescope. One of his special interests that I would really like to pick his brain on is redshift quasars. So maybe we can even touch on that. And we're going to focus today, though, on his work on site protection for dark skies. Welcome, Dr. Green. I'm really glad to talk to you.
Thank you, Susan. I'm really glad to be talking with you. This is fun.
Yeah. So I'm involved with a dark sky group and amateur astronomy in Wisconsin. And we're losing our dark skies very quickly. So I'm interested in what you have been doing to protect sites that are very valuable to the whole world, astronomical research sites.
Fortunately, here in Arizona, our predecessors recognized that having big professional telescopes on mountains adjacent to a growing metropolitan area required some real control of runaway lights. So Tucson and both the city and its encompassing county have had light pollution control ordinances on the books since the 1970s. But government out here is small and non-intrusive, and so the main challenge is getting everyone to recognize that having a dark sky is in their interest as well as an astronomer's interest. Mm-hmm. So I would say that Dark Sky International, which used to be the International Dark Sky Association, has laid out the principles that we've always been using to try to limit the growth of light in the sky. And step one is what they call fully shielded. Make sure that the light fixture itself isn't emitting light above horizontal, because that's the worst kind mm-hmm. of light trespass mm-hmm. into the sky. And so that seems so basic, and yet it's a real problem, you know, because tall poles are expensive, and so it's really tempting on an athletic field or even on a roadway to tilt that fixture up just a little bit so it illuminates down farther, and that sends light straight up into the sky and increases the sky glow. So we've made real progress here in some ways in that the State Highway Department is using tall poles and fully shielded fixtures, and the athletic fields in some of the parks are really have quality lighting in them, but it's more expensive, so it has to be budgeted for. Mm-hmm. And we try all the time to make people aware that they, in our case, they move to the desert because the desert is beautiful. Mm-hmm. It's unique landscape, and the night sky is just a part of that natural environment. So we try to get voluntary cooperation by reminding people that mm-hmm. that's why they moved here. Mm-hmm. They wanted to be part of, or grew up here. That's why they, and stayed, because they wanted to be part of that natural environment. And so, you know, in your part of the world, if it was naturally dark and people are moving there to enjoy that kind of, you know, non-urban place, you know, keeping the natural sky dark at night and not letting light trespass out, is really, you know, an important thing to try.
Yeah. Now, it seemed that you said when Kitt Peak first was built, they were thinking about controlling the night lighting in the surrounding area. So they didn't wait until they had a big out of control problem. That was part of starting the whole astronomy thing on the surrounding mountains?
Well, the first telescopes were put in place in the late 1950s on Kitt Peak, and by the early 70s they were already talking to the government officials about light pollution control. So, but the population out here grows very rapidly and steadily. So in the last half decade, the rate of population growth has been about 0.5% per year, which is a lot. So there's a double challenge because our metro area is about 1 million people.
Yeah.
So that has industry and transportation hubs and places that do 24/7 commercial operations and want safe lighting as they should have. Mm-hmm. But we need them to try to comply with this story of not letting that light trespass out of the work areas where they need
it. So on these observatories, in these observatories, do all the telescopes have a problem with light pollution or only light gathering telescopes? Would a radio telescope have a problem with light pollution? Because you have a lot of different kinds of telescopes up there.
That is true. So you're absolutely right. Light pollution is for the projects that need to observe in optical light, say, meaning from ultraviolet through the near infrared, and in a dark sky. So when the moon is out, the sky glow from the city is negligible, and when you go farther into the infrared, where it feels like heat to your hand, the sky is much brighter than anything the artificial lights do. So it really is about the darkest time when the moon is down and the sky is clear, and you're studying in optical wavelengths, that's when this light dome is a problem. Radio telescopes have a different kind of interference problem in two ways. I mean, they are subject to broadcasts from the ground, and so there are special arrangements made to protect radio telescopes.
Like when you go up there, you're supposed to turn your phone off.
For instance, yes, that's right. However, we have new days, right, in that there are satellites overhead all the time now, so we can't protect from that. So radio telescopes have more and more challenges finding quiet frequencies where there isn't man-made interference.
So all those things put out frequencies in various ways that can interfere with...
That's right. And so one of the things I spend my time on these days is trying to mitigate the impacts of all these satellite constellations that are going up for communications.
So. I know, I was out with a group last fall and Starlink went over and I was just horrified. I mean, it just made me sick to see that and to think how much more of that could be up there.
Right.
So you work also on that kind of interference.
Also, that's right, since we've gotten in that direction just briefly. But SpaceX has been among the most cooperative companies. Mm-hmm. They sit down. We have a group for our International Professional Society in Astronomy that is called the Center for Protection of the Sky.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a virtual group of an army of volunteers, but it's organized in a way where we have one, what we call a hub, and there are now 16 constellation operators and new space companies that sit down with astronomers and say, we didn't intend to make a problem for you, let's see how we can fix this.
Mm-hmm.
And so SpaceX, who operates Starlink, has been among the most cooperative, and they've already figured out a way how to make their satellites 50 times darker than they otherwise would be.
Oh, that's so, good news.
So they're actually trying. Now, have they gotten as faint as we wish they could be and kind of need them to be? Not yet. But yeah. they're still working yeah. on that and cooperating. And all the big operators, Amazon, Kuiper, mm-hmm. and OneWeb, and Eutelsat, which is the European counterpart, they're all working on ways to make their satellites appear darker than they would be if they mm-hmm. weren't treated at all. Mm-hmm. So, but we're talking about how to keep things dark on the, that's sort of the AC component, if you like. You know, mm-hmm. You get a streak in your image. And
right.
And the ground-based sort of glow in the sky is the DC component. You know, mm-hmm. that raises the brightness right. of the whole sky level right. and makes it harder for professionals to detect very faint objects and makes it hard for amateurs to get the perfect view of the dark night sky.
It would disrupt their data stream that they're trying to make sense out of.
Yeah, or if you have, oftentimes professional astronomers will have a brightness limit that they need to record to. And if you have 10% more light in the sky, you have to expose 20% longer just to get the same yeah. kind of information. And so it's just, okay. it's expense. You get okay. less done for that expensive hour okay. of telescope time now if the sky gets that much brighter.
I was going to ask how scientists compensate for those pollution interferences, or if they even can compensate. So you're saying there are some ways they can compensate. Are there limits to that compensation?
There are. I mean, there are just practical limits. Mm-hmm. You know, if you were trying to do something and it took you 20% longer to do it, you might say, okay. And if it took you 50% longer, you would just say, I'm going to go somewhere else where there are better tools. Yeah. So a long time ago, our International Professional Society put out a standard that said if there's natural glow in the sky, our atmosphere glows. So this is what man-made lighting adds to that glow. Mm-hmm. And what our professional society said in 1980 was that if that glow adds more than 10% to the natural glow in the sky, then that really isn't a place to do dark sky astronomy anymore.
Oh, okay. And there's also the issue of you have a certain amount of time on a telescope. Many people use these instruments. So if you have to run over a lot, there's cost, but there's also somebody else isn't able to maybe use
right.
a telescope when they were scheduled to use it.
That's right. It makes it more inefficient
yeah.
as well.
Yeah.
A lot of the modern telescopes now are running what they call Q mode. And so everybody's programs are loaded in, and it's a professional observer who comes and says, okay, tonight it's partly cloudy, and so I won't try this very faint thing. I'll get this other program and try to. So you use the time as efficiently as you can. But even so, if there's artificial light in the sky, it just takes longer to do mm-hmm. whatever it is you mm-hmm. want to do that you were planning on that very dark yeah. sky.
Well, you're focused really on the scientists, and there's what humans can learn and how it affects our life in many ways, from aircraft navigation to, medicine, all kinds of things. Astronomy feeds down into other parts of human life. But can you speak at all to just people like me, an average person who cares in general about having a healthy quality of life and would like things to be sort of normal out there? What's, besides the value for the scientists, can you say anything about your understanding of why these dark skies, we all should care about it? What's important to us?
So, as far as we can tell, the natural world developed its ways of doing business in a dark sky. So many insect pollinators, many birds, many animals do all their activities at night. And they're disrupted if the lighting is not the natural dark sky lighting. They've done wonderful tests, if you like, top-tier predators, and they find that mountain lions will go miles and miles out of their way to avoid light. Mm-hmm. And they found that there are certain kinds of creatures which are less relevant to Wisconsin and for sure Arizona, but like sea turtles, mm-hmm. if there's artificial light, they will, the hatchlings will go the wrong direction and get eaten on the beach rather than make it to the ocean to mm-hmm. to reproduce. So that's just an example right. of how many right. natural cycles there are that get disrupted by artificial lighting. So if we depend on honeybees and birds and, you know, just, oh, there are stunning examples of artificial lighting disrupting crop growth.
Yeah, plants too.
Exactly, yeah. Because they are used to a day-night cycle to be at their healthiest. And yes, there are greenhouses that accelerate growth, but in general, it disrupts the growth of crops. And so for every reason for our health on the planet, it's good to focus the light we need at night right onto the area where we need it and mm-hmm. not have it spilling out into places where it still needs to be naturally dark. There's well-established medical evidence that human exposure to unusual amounts of light at night disrupt your health. But that is probably more about indoor light. That may be more about indoor lighting mm-hmm. than actual outdoor lighting when you're outside. Mm-hmm. So it depends on lighting levels. And mostly, we also, on the one hand, we're internally wired to be scared of the dark. And on the other hand, we're also internally wired to appreciate that dark sky that, you know, was also part of our internal wiring. So yeah. that, you know, yeah. sleep cycles go better when it's actually not shining exterior light into your window. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we're healthier human beings if there is a natural day-night cycle. You don't have to have a blackout shade.
Yeah, I think of scientists as kind of canary in the coal mine, because many of these changes you talk about where artificial light at night damages some natural process happens slowly enough we don't really notice it until it's quite advanced, where you notice it at the observatory right away when something's interfering with what you need to do. So and sometimes people say, well, I don't care if they can't see the next galaxy. What does that have to do with life, you know? But I think beyond the benefits of whatever the science learns is that you do notice things before we do out on the ground and not observing as carefully maybe. And so your observations and your understanding of what you're observing can help us all.
We think so. It's also been very interesting for me to work with our international scientific community, because different parts of the world have very different attitudes about what's important, but it's important to everyone in some way, in that, as an example, our European colleagues are very conscious of these environmental issues that we just talked mm-hmm. about. The US system is set up more for the quiet enjoyment of our property. Mm-hmm. And so, like trespass, you know, if somebody else is doing something that impacts my property, you know, I had a legal right to that dark sky that they've trespassed mm-hmm. on. And so, you know, there are different approaches that, you know, appeal to mm-hmm. different groups of people, mm-hmm. but you know, that one is an interesting one in the U.S. where, you know, your obligation, if you need to light and want to light, you know, that light had better be confined pretty much to what you're doing and not, you know, not impact other people, because right. that's
so far
unfair.
We think of sound pollution as annoying us if someone's playing music we don't like, but mm-hmm. we haven't yet registered that we've been shielding our eyes from that yard light for a long time, but that's trespass just as much as sound pollution.
Absolutely, yeah. It is. That's yeah. right. And so that's why I'm getting back to these international dark sky principles, you know, where you put the light where you want it and only when you need it. You know, we are big advocates for motion sensing. Mm-hmm. So that, you know, rather than having that light on all night long, you know, if there's some activity that needs the lighting, the activity is sensed, the lights come on, and you do what you do safely, and then when it goes quiet for a while, those lights go off because you don't need them anymore.
Right. It's not about no lights and being in the dark. It's about appropriate lighting.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And uniformly distributed, very low lighting makes it a lot easier to see than really bright spots of light mm-hmm. with dark shadows in between. And it's just, it's amazing yes. how well you can hide in those shadows.
Yeah, so the glare blinds you to the shadows.
It does. Yes. So for safety, having low good lighting makes all the mm-hmm. difference in the world. More light is not more safe.
Well, I've noticed being in Tucson how easy it is to get around the city in the dark and how dark the city is. And I don't hear anybody complaining here. You've lived here a long time and have been directly involved in that process of controlling light pollution in Tucson. And you've also traveled a lot and been in other places. So can you say anything about living in a city of 1 million people that there are streets with no street lights and it's dark here? It's dark.
It is.
Yeah. What's that like?
So people really appreciate this desert. You know, it's fantastic when the coyotes and the wild boars are wandering by and doing their thing. And similarly, sitting in a backyard and actually being able to see the Milky Way is something that, you know, we treasure. So, and the safety statistics are just not different from anywhere else. Mm-hmm. You know, mm-hmm. your car lights are designed to make you a safe driver. And the only time there really needs to be lights is where there's heavy pedestrian activity mixed in with cars. So, you know, some intersections with crossings will be lighted, but while you're driving on the road, lights don't add much, and in fact, mm-hmm. they're distracting.
Mm-hmm.
So most people feel that the level of lighting is adequate and appreciate that there's a reason astronomers built telescopes here, because mm-hmm. you have this unprecedented mm-hmm. view of the sky. And so any natural area like that that is not densely settled and, you know, has beautiful land and allows you to enjoy that connection to nature, it's worth it, you know.
We argue it
actually increases the properties that have highest value are in the darkest places.
Oh, now that's interesting.
Here.
So the neighborhoods and the
fancy neighborhoods are dark.
yeah, they are, yeah. Well, in closing, do you have anything to say about what you anticipate in the future? Do you think that we're doing a good enough job on keeping light pollution under control, or are we losing the battle, or is there a good prognosis for this being something we can get a handle on in the future?
I'm an inveterate optimist, probably in the face of statistics that aren't very encouraging at the moment. In that, one of my colleagues runs a program that's called Globe at Night, and it's wonderful citizen science where people can go into their backyards with a star map and look for the faintest star they can see on a moonless night. And they've been doing this over a decade or more, and so they have a time sequence to say, you know, in given areas, how have things changed? And one way of interpreting their data is that the sky has been getting brighter by almost 10% per year because of people's losing the ability to see the faintest mm-hmm. stars. Now, that's a complicated number, but the trend is getting higher. I'll say it a different way. In our metro area, the population grows at about 0.5% per year. The amount of light in the sky detected by a satellite passing overhead and looking down has increased by 2% per year.
Mm-hmm.
So the amount of light per person seems to be going up steadily. Mm-hmm. And so that makes no sense. You know, it's you paid for that light to light up your sidewalk, not go into the sky or into your neighbor's yard. You know, so it's wasting money. If there were any other thing that you were spending money on, you wouldn't throw it away like that.
Yeah.
There has been a revolution in lighting in general and outdoor lighting as well, with the solid state lights called LEDs. So they give you a lot more light per watt of electric power. But rather than saving money, people seem to be lighting up more, maybe making it brighter or been making more lights, because in general, the satellites looking down have seen everything continuing to get brighter.
Do you think a lot of that is because people are simply unaware that A, they could save money, and B, they're causing a problem with that kind of lighting, and it's a matter of who knew, you know?
Yes, I think that's a big part of it, because I think once people do know, you know, A, you want to save money, and B, you want to sort of not harass your neighbor in general, and have some effect of preserving the natural night for our environment, for the nature around us, and just for the enjoyment of everybody.
So, to move into the future, you and the people you work with are in ongoing interactions with the city and the county and other entities to continue to improve the light quality here.
Because of our years of interacting with them, the elected officials are very supportive, and it's just a question of having an actively growing community and people moving in from other places who aren't as conscious of the fact that we want to keep the sky dark here. Mm-hmm. So finding ways that when people put in new lights, they follow that prescription of full shielding them, of directing the light to where it needs to go, to turning it off when you don't need it, just basic basics. And then Tucson is highly unusual, and we're going around right now on that, because we've drawn circles around the mountains with the giant telescopes on them and said, inside those places, it has to be particularly dark. And so you have a limit on how much outdoor light you can provide on your property, and that's the city and the county regulation. So, so they're very supportive. It's also very small government, so it's not like there's a sheriff who comes around and says, you've got one too many lights.
Yeah.
We have to rely on people wanting to pull in the same direction and trying to do that. So I will say that there's, again, using the data from that satellite that looks down and see how much light is shining up, there's an almost perfect straight line between the population of a town and how much light is going up into the sky. So everybody sort of does the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
Las Vegas is way above that.
Yeah.
And Tucson is fairly far below it.
Mm-hmm.
So
mm-hmm.
if you make a conscious effort, you know, it's not like the light going into the sky is zero by any means, but it can be made lower, and that's what we work on.
And it's affordable and doable. It's not complicated or hard to make those lighting changes.
That's right.
Yeah.
It's our real money. You paid for it. Send it where you want it.
Well, I hope we can talk again, because I would love to talk to you about quasars and other things that I know some of my audience would like to hear about too.
Absolutely.
So thank you very much for your insights on what's going on in Tucson.
You bet. Thanks for this opportunity.
That's our program for today, folks. Thanks for listening. Tune in again, and you can catch us on podcasts anytime, WDRT. Take care. We'll go out and look at the stars.